This is an ABC podcast.
On a random Monday morning in Papua New Guinea, Facebook went dark.
So my contact's asking, am I the only person not able to go on Facebook? And then I started to see more frequent statuses. Sorry, I can't go onto Facebook. And so I started to realize that something was not right.
All around the country, people weren't able to message family members and businesses couldn't connect with their customers.
I think people didn't really grasp what was happening until later on that day.
This shutdown wasn't a glitch. Instead, Papua New Guinea's police minister revealed something surprising.
And so what he had said was that the shutdown of Facebook was a test under PNG's anti-terrorism laws to what the government's ability was just to try and see if they can control the platform itself.
Papua New Guineans were shocked but not surprised by this, because the government has had a testy relationship with the ways people express themselves, whether it's on social media or in the press. And there are concerns the power the government has over this is increasing, using a myriad of laws to control and suppress. Hi, I'm Scott Wyde, and this is Politalk, where I'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it affects us. I'll speak with politicians from across the Pacific region and with everyday people about the political experiences that shape us. Today on Politalk, when it comes to the laws around freedom of expression and freedom of speech in Papua New Guinea, who do they protect and who do they punish? And what's at stake for free speech in the digital age?
I should say that the government has a Department of Information and Communication Technology. This department is directly in communication with Meta. So they do all the stuff like verifications, they do stuff like Facebook, all the socials, and they try to monitor.
Belinda Cora is an ABC journalist based in Papua New Guinea. She's also watched carefully as the PNG government's relationship with social media has evolved since its early days.
Social media probably came in like 2011. It's such a massive growth over the years, which has demonstrated how big the country is and how they're able to communicate more better using Facebook.
Belinda, how are social media platforms in PNG used?
Papua New Government uses a social media platform like Facebook to put out political messages. And they have social media platforms to also help Papua New Guinean people like women who have small businesses and need to connect to their customers. And of course, SMEs are growing in the country for our females. It has also enabled people to have provincial forums, political forums, women groups, youth groups.
While there's often lots of productive discussions in these groups, there's also a lot of misinformation that can be drummed up as well. How have you seen this play out?
As a reporter and covering issues, like I think one of the ones I can zoom into would be the violence in the Highlands province. Videos are being shared that are probably from 10 years or probably 5 years ago. And of course, people aren't having that time or knowledge of trying to verify these videos. And so they share them, they continue to share them. And so what had happened in one particular video, which was probably 5 years old, what I did notice was that after the video was shared, basically what I do as a journalist is I need to call the community around there and the police to try and verify if this happened just last night, because they said it was last night. And so what happened was that I found out, it was way back and they've already dealt with the issue. But then the thing was that when I was making those calls, it was already being shared. So another fight had erupted.
And so with issues like misinformation on social media, how has the PNG government responded to this?
I think in 2016, they put out a Cybercrime Act. It set up as a legal framework to address cybercrime, cyberbullying, hacking, identity theft, all of that. It is supposed to cover and try to address these issues.
But there are those in Papua New Guinea who believe the Cybercrime Act isn't always being used for genuine cybercrimes. And they worry that it could be used by powerful people to intimidate those that try to hold them to account, like Eddie Tanago.
My name is Eddie Tanago, and I am the campaign manager for the advocacy organization called ACNOW. ACNOW is a community advocacy organization, and what we basically do is assist ordinary people, make their voices heard, especially on areas of national importance in Papua New Guinea.
Eddie's advocacy organization, Act Now, campaigns on issues like protecting customary land and corruption in PNG and illegal logging.
Illegal logging in Papua New Guinea is as old as itself, or as old as Papua New Guinea, or the country itself, and has been well documented over the years. In the last 3 years, we have been looking at one particular license called the Forest Clearing Authority. FCA is a type of a logging license issued by the PNG Forest Authority. And the license is meant for small and discrete area of forest clearance for agriculture, basically for agriculture.
Eddie alleged that these licenses are being misused.
The evidence that we've uncovered shows that they are being systematically abused to allow for large-scale selective logging operations over huge areas of forests. And the kind of abuses that we had identified is that these permits cover large areas of forest, which are much larger than what is needed for agriculture, and often on land that is not suitable for agriculture. We then held what we called an FCA, or Forest Clearing Authority, seminar in November of 2024, with the aim of trying to bring FCA landowners and civil societies and to discuss the compounding evidence that we had gathered.
On November 14th, Papua New Guinea's FM 100 program, one of the country's most popular talkback shows, posted on Facebook that the Forest Authority's managing director, John Masoro, would be joining the show to respond to Eddie's claims. The post included a picture of John Masoro along with the details of the interview. The next day, Eddie reshared the post on the Act Now Facebook page.
So I said again to our followers, telling them that, you know, the boss is, and the team is coming on FM 100, so you might as well just tune in to listen to the responses that he'd be giving.
Eddie thought that this was a regular thing to do, to reshare a Facebook post. But this one action threw his life into chaos.
You know, I really didn't expect it to be arrested or the police to front up at my place.
Eddie, tell me about the day you were arrested.
It was 7 o'clock a.m. in the morning when I was being picked up and taken to Gordon's police station. It was my first time to be arrested and such, so it was really, really a tough time for me, and it all happened in front of my wife and kid. So when I went in, I was being told that I had a complaint filed against me by a senior public officer for posting his image without his consent. So I was arrested for defamation and charged for one count.
How did you feel when you found out about this charge?
My immediate thought was to really, you know, get in touch with my colleagues and my families and inform them, then get a lawyer. I understood a bit about the Cybercrime Act from a layman's perspective generally, but my arrest really made me to be more aware of the law itself, and it was really a huge surprise. Because in the last 17 years of working on the issue, I was never been arrested and charged. It got me by surprise and even made me think if I'm really doing the right thing. It was really challenging for me personally and my family.
After your arrest, you were let out on bail, and then you went to your first mention at the Waigani Committal Court, where you were told that the charge was actually identity theft instead of defamation. How did you feel during this time, and what impact did it have on your everyday life?
It was very, very shocking for many who were worried and had to come to check on me and my family. The support, though, was overwhelming and really, really helped from the financial perspective. You know, going through back and forth, having a legal representation is very, very expensive. This very small experience of mine had really made me realize how expensive it is.
For months, you were in and out of court, but then in April 2025, the charges against you were struck out, with the magistrate determining that the police had not produced enough evidence. How did you feel when that happened?
I was actually in a courtroom when the magistrate made the decision. So it was a very huge relief. I was just wishing it was somewhere outside where I could scream my lungs out.
The charges brought against you were under PNG's Cybercrime Act. How has this experience impacted on your perspective? on those laws?
You know, after going through this ordeal, we've realized that, you know, the Act itself is a very dangerous piece of legislation because it is open for people in positions of power to use the influence to stop freedom of speech and attack their critics. You know, in PNG, we have a lot of problems and to find solutions. We all need to be able to speak freely about what is going wrong and really risk becoming a failed state or a state that is dictatorial in nature.
It's a big ordeal to go through. How did you view this experience in the broader context of civil society work in Papua New Guinea?
You know, it sends a very, very bad message that PND leaders are more concerned about silencing their critics rather than dealing with the issues the country is facing. But also, most importantly, the small people. The people need to know because, you know, it's happened to me now. Tomorrow could happen to anybody.
Polytalk has reached out to the PNG Forest Authority Managing Director, John Masoro, for comment, but has not received a reply. But before Eddie Tanago's charges were dropped, Mr. Masoro told the ABC in a statement that he wanted to get down to the bottom of illegal logging activities in the forestry sector and stop forest clearing licenses in the country. He also said that ACNOW did not appreciate what he's doing to reform forestry, saying he strongly condemned ACNOW PNG's actions without consulting PNG Forest Authority publications of the article with the face and photograph on it. Polytalk has also reached out to the PNG government for a response to Eddie's experience and to ask what is being done to make sure the Cybercrime Act isn't being used to intimidate and silence people. We have not received a reply.
Papua New Guinea is a country that is proud to have a free press. And its constitution's provisions on freedom of expression and other human rights are quite explicit. So I was a bit surprised that, you know, this happened. So we had to take a closer look at the situation.
Mark Subreros is Papua New Guinea's UN human rights advisor, and he's been watching how PNG uses the law around issues like freedom of expression. Mark, what did you make of the case against Eddie Tanago?
What happened in Eddie's case, where the police at first charged him with defamation under the Cybercrime Act and then changed the charge to identity theft, is a good illustration of the awareness, no? Within the legal community, among law enforcement officials, and general public, on how the Cybercrime Act interacts with the constitutional provisions and freedom of expression. So there is it's an indication that there is a bit of vagueness in the way the provision of the Cybercrime Act are being interpreted and then they're being applied. As the case went on, you can see that the case was adjourned at least three times for the reason that the police were still trying to complete their investigation. So from an observer's standpoint, that's an indication that they were also grappling with coming up with the right interpretation of the law.
How did you feel when you saw the charges had been struck out?
I took it as a positive sign that the judiciary is an independent institution. It continues to be an independent institution and that there is a sensitivity, right, on the possible negative impacts of prosecutions under Cybercrime Act on freedom of expression, on the activities and the work of human rights defenders in general.
Does the fact that this case even happened concern you?
It should still bother us because it's still possible that, you know, similar cases will happen in the future. So we need to address the root cause of the problem, which is we need to have an assessment of the constitutionality of the Cybercrime Act's provisions insofar as they may be impinging on the exercise of fundamental freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution and by PNG's human rights obligations.
Eddie Tanago's case is enough to make anyone in Papua New Guinea pause before deciding to post on Facebook. And while the laws like the Cybercrime Act were created to address real problems like identity theft, misinformation and defamation, as Mark Sebreros explains, it all comes down to how the law is interpreted by the police, the legal society and the judges. It's something that Papua New Guinea's journalists are closely watching. as they often find themselves targeted for their reporting.
My name is Neville Choi. I am president of the Media Council of Papua New Guinea.
Now, a disclaimer. Neville and I go way back. We both worked at Papua New Guinea's TV station, MTV, for many years. And we've both seen how our reporting has ruffled feathers. So much so that in 2019, Neville was sacked.
I can remember very clearly. It was a Monday morning. I was energized to go in and get started on what I thought was going to be a productive week.
Take me back to that time you were working at MTV as the news and current affairs manager. What happened on that day you were fired?
I walk into the MTV front office and I'm immediately stopped by the security guard on duty and advised that I should sit at reception and await further instructions. That was all I was told, so I really didn't know what was happening until the HR manager came out and brought me into the boardroom. Even then, I wasn't told anything, so I was asking him what this was all about. He wouldn't say anything. He said the CEO would come in and explain. And when she did, it was to issue me my termination notice. So it was pretty jarring.
And what kind of stories were you working on?
2019 was just a year after APEC, after PNG hosted APEC here in Port Moresby. So some of the stories that we were working on then were the soldiers or the PNG Defence Force soldiers had some pay issues with relation to the operations around APEC, so we were covering that story. But it also came on the back of what was happening or what happened during APEC, what happened in the lead up to APEC. So there was an atmosphere of the country or the government trying to put on a good show for APEC. So I think the government trying to ensure that PNG was seen in a good light around hosting APEC probably came with its concerns about how the country was being portrayed in the media.
What reason were you given for your sacking?
I think it was mostly around what the CEO described as insubordination. There hadn't been any prior notices of or warnings of insubordination, so I was kind of surprised with it.
Can you explain the structure of MTV and how it's connected to the PNG government?
Well, MTV is fully owned by Telecom PNG, which is a state-owned enterprise under the PNG government. So they're 100% owned by Telecom. MTV has a managing board that reports to the Telecom board. And the Telecom board reports to the Minister for State-Owned Enterprises.
What happened immediately after you were sacked?
The CEO informed me that I would not be able to enter the newsroom under any circumstances from that point onwards, that I wasn't supposed to have any contact with the newsroom or my team, and that I couldn't even collect my personal belongings.
What about your newsroom? What did they do?
The newsroom, the team did not put together a bulletin for that evening's 6 p.m. Bulletin, and then they stayed away the next day and did not produce a news bulletin for that also.
What reaction was there around the region to your sacking?
A lot of the support from the Pacific came from either media academics, veteran media journalists, practitioners throughout different countries in the region, journalism groups. Most of them said that it was an attack on media freedom, and that it was the beginning of a dangerous trend of trying to curb freedom of speech.
There was a huge outcry from media around the Pacific to your sacking. And like you mentioned, the MTV newsroom went on strike, refusing to produce news bulletins. Eventually, a few days later, you got your job back. What did that experience tell you about media freedom at the time and through to now?
What it told me, I guess, was that national government or national leaders, depending on their level of understanding of how the media works in the mainstream, somehow have decided or have seen that there is some level of impact in how they are publicly perceived, whether it's on public comments on social media or in the mainstream, people venting their frustrations or airing their frustrations about things that are supposed to be done but that aren't being done. And I think the concern for me is how this uneasiness at the national level trickles down through, say, either ministers or boards to affect leaderships at the newsroom level. The media remains free, and I think at some there must be some understanding of and recognition of the independence of newsrooms and independent media, and the freedom for media to practice without being pressured not to publish or not to air or not to broadcast.
Recently, the Papua New Guinea government's communications minister, Timothy Masiu, put forward a media development policy to regulate the press. What did you think of that?
Well, the first draft of the national media development policy was one that didn't contain any input from industry. Now, as we all know, that's moved on to a version 5, and what we now have is a National Executive Council approved national media development policy, but one that includes all the recommendations that industry through the Media Council have suggested and have been included into it. What I think of it is we have never had a national policy in law that governs media in Papua New Guinea. So while there may be many advocates of media who say that this is not a good trend, what the Media Council's perspective has been throughout this whole process is that we be part of this process of developing this policy, because there are issues like the remuneration of media professionals in the country, which has never had a standard to look at or to follow. Ensuring a proper acknowledged legal pay grading system for the media. These things cannot be achieved without a media policy. We have ensured that the current media policy in its current form ensures self-regulation of the media in PNG.
How important is media freedom for Papua New Guinea?
I think it's vitally important. What if we don't have a free press and a free media, what our citizens then have to fall back to is social media. And it's very difficult to try and navigate social media these days to determine what's actual news and what's fake news or what's just been forwarded without verification. I think having a free press that abides by the traditions of journalism that champion integrity, accountability, and transparency is still better than placing your faith in what you're seeing on social media.
Free speech in Papua New Guinea is protected by the Constitution, but recent events show how fragile that protection can be. From sudden social media shutdowns to the arrest of activists like Eddie Tanago under the cybercrime laws. The digital space is becoming increasingly risky for those who speak out. These laws, originally designed to protect against real threats, can be used in ways that could silence dissent and discourage accountability. And it's a blurry line between whether these laws are helping or harming people in PNG. Politalk is hosted by me, Scott Waide. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna. Next week on Politalk, on Christmas Eve, a private video of Fijian MP Linda Tambuya was leaked online.
A close associate of mine called me late in the evening, just basically saying, hey, I've seen something online. It's personal and it's spreading quickly.
I was really shocked.
When I received the notification, I thought, okay, this is a very personal attack. I wasn't really even thinking so much about how it would affect me and my profession as a cabinet minister in parliament. I thought it was a very personal attack so that it would affect me personally. My mind was racing, and you know, here I had a very private moment now turned into a public spectacle.
In a matter of moments, her political career had been rocked to its core. She was stripped of a cabinet position, and she says she was made to feel like a criminal, even though a crime had been committed against her.
It hurt me a lot because I believed that my loyalty and service deserved a lot more understanding. I mean, it was horrendous in terms of the critics that came through. There were a lot of moral judgment, basically questioning, why did I do the video in the first place? Questioning my judgment. It was immoral, and that I was risking exposing myself by doing that. And I understood, though, that not everyone would be sympathetic. I was just bracing for that impact, that I would be critiqued. I was really, really shocked, and I also felt a sense of betrayal.
Next week on Polytalk, I'll uncover how digital abuse is being weaponized against women in politics and what it means for democracy in the Pacific.
So it was infuriating in the sense that it reinforced how some Fiji's political system is still quite unsafe for women, especially younger women, wanting to get into politics. It shows that how women are still vulnerable within the system, and that character assassination, such as leaking private videos, is still seen as one of the most effective tools to silence women in politics generally. Personally, I see it as an example, or it's a textbook case of character assassination, in the sense that this video was a personal video, and the way it was exposed and weaponized, it was meant to humiliate her, to delegitimize her authority. She's a growing political superstar of sorts, and she's quite popular in Fiji. So I think it served a purpose to actually undermine her political career, the rise in her political career.
Most cases that come to us, which is using this technology, is done to women, and often from men, when they were romantically aligned to each other, might have taken some compromising videos and so on. Then they try to blackmail the person to come back, or like what we call sextorting. If you don't respond to me, you don't come and meet me here to have sex or something, I will release all these videos, those threats and intimidation and so on. So because of that, and in domestic violence situations, to get her back again and get some money out of her blackmailing and things like that.
On Polytalk with me, Scott Wydeh. Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.